today's talk has to do with large deviations for random graphs and random matrices. What I'm talking about is some joint work with Saurav Chatterjee, a colleague at NYU, and some of this you can find on the archive. So we are talking about large deviations for a dozen any random graphs. It's not quite a dozen any random graph, but it's something like it. Because for those who remember, a dozen any random graph is you take n vertices, and then randomly you select certain pairs and put edges between them. And the probability that an edge is really there depends on n. It's a constant over n, so that the degree of any vertex is finite. What we are going to do is something different. We are going to leave p alone. P is going to be fixed, and n is going to infinity, so the degree of every vertex is becoming very large and infinite. So there are lots and lots of edges, and if you think of it as a graph, it's a mess. Okay. So we are interested in the behavior of large random graphs. So there are n choose two edges. These are turned, each one is turned on independently with probability p. We then have a probability measure qn on the space of 2 to the n choose two possible graphs. You can think of it as a random matrix. From a graph, you generate a random matrix of zeros and ones. You make all the diagonals zero, and the ijth entry is one if there is a bond or an edge that connects the ith and jth vertices. So you can think, visualize your random graph as a random matrix, symmetric random matrix, because the edges are not directed. So the probability that's assigned to any specific matrix is just p to the k times 1 minus p to the power n choose 2 minus k, where k is the number of edges that are present. So you can look at a finite subgraph, any finite graph, for instance, a triangle or a complete graph with four vertices or any kind of a finite graph, and then you can try to count how many times it appears in your random graph. For instance, you can count the number of triangles in your random graph. The law of large numbers tells you that the number of triangles is n choose 3, and the probability that a triangle is really there, because all three edges are connected, is p cubed. So the expected value of the number of triangles is n choose 3 times p cubed. So if you normalize by n cubed, it's p cubed over 6, roughly the expectation. And they're not independent, but they're almost, you know, they're dependent only if two triangles overlap, they have a common edge. Such pairs of triangles are relatively small in number, and therefore it's clear that the law of large numbers anyway holds. And therefore, you have this result that n over n cubed is very close to p cubed over 6 with very high probability. So now, as a large deviant, I had to ask the next question: what is the probability that n over n cubed is not p cubed over 6, but some other number a or c or whatever it is you want it to be? And is there a rate function that you can compute for large deviations of this? And then you can ask, well, there's nothing special about triangles. You can do quadrilaterals, complete four graphs, any kind of a graph that you want. You should be able to calculate this large deviation rate function. Or even sometimes you want two such things to be combined. You want the number of triangles to be such and such, and number of quadrilaterals to be such and such. You specify a collection of these things. And so long as you have a finite collection, you should be able to calculate large deviations for this. Another important question which is always underlying in large deviations, see, there are two ways of doing large deviation. You can compute some exponential moments and then use Gartner-Ellis theorem or something like that, and then you get use Chebyshev's inequality, you get an estimate, you get upper and lower estimates, and you show that there is a large deviation principle. But that doesn't tell you how the large deviation arose, what caused it. Okay. On the other hand, when you do it by Kramer-type tilting argument, and you know what's the optimal tilting, that tells you what is the most likely way this large deviation arose. And then you can also compute, conditioned on this large deviation having occurred, what are the other things that might have happened. For example, if the number of triangles is too many, does it mean that the number of quadrilaterals are also too many? Right? Questions like that you can ask if you have a complete control of the large deviations and not just the rate function for one thing at a time. So that's what I mean by what kind of graphs contribute to these events. So the first step in any large deviation theory is you want one space which doesn't depend on n to do your large deviation theory in. So the first thing we have to decide is what's our space. Well, you can embed the vertices 1 to n as subintervals of the unit interval. So I take the unit interval, divide it into n parts, and associate each subinterval with a vertex. So the ith vertex get associated with the subinterval I minus 1 by n tau over n. Then the graph can be embedded as a random function on the square. Namely, you know, I have these intervals, I have n intervals on the x-axis, n intervals on the y-axis, so I have n square little squares, diagonals are all 0, or the off-diagonal entries I put 0 or 1, depending on whether that particular combination of vertices have an edge connecting them or not. So the matrix that I have, I just put boxes around it, so to speak, and think of it as a function defined on the unit square. And that's what this expression here tells you. So now I have all my probability measures are probability measures and the space of functions on the square. So I want to do my large deviation on the space of functions on the square. These are functions which take 0 or 1, but in the limit, they're going to be between 0 and 1, sort of, they don't have to be 0. Their limits could be some kind of a weak limit, they would lie between 0 and 1, and not necessarily at the extreme values. In fact, the law of large numbers, in some sense, should tell you that these random functions converge to P, which is the original probability in some sense. Okay? So it looks like everything is nice. We have a beautiful setup. Under weak convergence, the space of functions on the square bounded by between 0 and 1 is a nice compact space. And so large deviations, you always, it's nice to have some compactness or some coercivity on it. So it looks like everything is nice. And the rate function is also very simple, because it's simply you want, more than your share of edges is what you can do. How can you perturb a system? You have a system with, some probability for each edge, instead, that will generate a constant p. So you want your zeros and ones to look like a function f of x, y, then the probability of an edge connecting x and y should be this function f of x, y rather than p. And you do that for every one, and you normalize by n square. Only half the edges need to count because of symmetry. It's only one side of the triangle, so you get a factor of half. And so the sum becomes an interim on some integral in the end. So you have a nice large deviation function. So you have solved the problem immediately. Well, if it were that simple, I wouldn't be here today talking about it. The topology is too weak. The weak topology is no good. Because if you look at the triangle count, it's the simple integral. The number of triangles, if you compute, you have to have three legs that come back together. So it's a cubic. Cubics are notoriously discontinuous and don't like weak conversions. Okay. So weak topology is no good. Strong topology is too strong. Because in strong topology, you don't even have the law of large numbers. Because these your approximating functions are all 0, 1. In no way are they going to converge in the strong topology to a function which is between 0 and 1. So strong is too strong and weak is too weak. We have to find something in between. So a good compromise exists. It is called the cut topology. Now, many of you may not have heard about it. I didn't know about it until a few months ago, but I'll tell you what it is. In weak topology, your functions fn, you want it to converge to f in the weak topology. You use a test function phi, and you say integral of fn against phi tends to integral of f against phi. And you do this for every phi that's bounded by 1, that's enough, and that's your weak topology. Strong topology says you do the same thing, but you say that it's uniform over all phi bounded by 1. That's strong topology. In the cut topology, you're only allowed to choose functions which are products, a function of x times a function of y. And each piece must be bounded by 1, and you take the soup over all of that. That's clearly weaker than the strong topology. Okay. And it implies the weak topology for the simple reason that any function of two variables can be approximated by sums of functions, each of which are products. So the linear combination of products tell you that weak topology is okay here. So the cut topology is really something in between. So a little weaker than the strong topology. So if you have a finite graph and you want to count the number of occurrences of such graph, the object you would look at is a functional like this. What it tells you, it multiplies your function, which is defined for every edge, fixj, over all possible edges, and then integrates this. And you can check that for some normalization, which is some combinatorial number, this essentially calculates suitably normalized the number of graphs, number of times the graph gamma appears. For triangle, we saw what it was before. It makes sense for anything else. Let's go back to triangles. And I claim that these are continuous functions in the... Yes? How do you see that it's weak enough that you get convergence to the constant p for the function itself, the law of large numbers? How is it? Why is law of large numbers valid in the cut topology? I'll come to that. I will. Consider triangles. You just change one fn to f at a time. If you want to change here fn to f, the first one, then you have to show that something like that goes to zero. Now, if you look at it here, I have something which is in a function of x1 and x2, but that's multiplied by a function. I will never see here x2 and x3. Badges. All the functions you see on the other side will be products involving either x2 And so this integral, just integrating with respect to x1 and x2, since all these guys are bounded by 1, converges to 0, you in all the, you can always replace one of these. So that shows. So you replace one edge at a time, it works. And the same thing, even if it's a triangle, you have more complicated graphs, you will have more terms instead of just one term here, but it's involving separate things. So it goes to zero. Seems reasonable to take as our space X with cut topology. And you can define a metric on the cut topology. The distance between two functions is defined like this. It turns out the cut topology can also be defined in terms of sets. You just limit yourself to sets which are rectangles. So instead of taking the supremum over all Borel sets, you look at the two measures, if you like, f dx dy and g dx dy, and look at the difference over all the possible rectangles A cross B, and take the supremum over A and B. And that is equivalent to the metric in the cut topology. So cut topology is actually a nice metrizable topology. Now I come to answer your question, why is the law of large numbers valid for the cut topology? Well, it's a question of showing that the supremum over all A and B of NAB over N squared minus mod A bar B goes to zero, basically. That's what you need to prove. Each one of them goes to zero by law of large numbers. And problem is really the soup. So soup is the problem. Now, it's not difficult to show that for the supremum, it's enough to take them as complete intervals, because everything is constant over intervals, so you can convince yourself easily that the soup of A and B can be taken to be this union of intervals. You don't need to take complicated sets. So how many are there? How many intervals are there, n intervals? So A can be any collection of intervals, union of them. So there are at most 2 to the n A's, 2 to the n B's, so 2 to the n times 2 to the n. Altogether, the soup involves 2 to the 2 n things. The large deviation rate for this is that since there are n square possible edges, is e to the minus n square. So the law of large numbers comes with the error rate of e to the minus c times n square, and to do the cut topology, I had to soup over only 2 to the n times 2 to the n, which is negligible compared to e to the c n square. So that answers your question. So you can immediately get large deviation lower bounds, because all you do is you do a tilting and you do this argument law of large numbers for the tilted measure is no different than the other one, and you can take the soup easily, so you get convergence in the cut topology. And that proves the large deviation lower bound. And if you want to, the argument is the same argument I put on the board yesterday or the day before. It's basically Jensen's inequality and entropy, and the entropy would give you the, if you want, the empirical F that you get, you want it to be in a neighborhood of some function F, the estimate is of this form. So this is the rate function we saw before. So now comes the problem of upper bound. The rate function we know already. So to do any reasonable large deviations, you need to have some kind of exponential tightness or something like that. Otherwise, it doesn't really work because the upper bound little sets, and then you have to take your set, close set, to cover it, little set, So the closer to the compact you can do. So and to some compact set, arbitrary closed sets, you have to do. Is it still making noise? No, no, it seems to have stopped now. Okay, good. Okay, where was I? So you cover it by finite number. Cell phone is interfering. Okay, maybe just clear it up. Okay. So you need some kind of a compactness, and the way it's usually done is you prove a super exponential estimate that, you know, outside of a compact set there is not much happening. So at least what you need is you want the level sets to be compact. So if you take the rate function and look at all the points where the rate function is below a certain level, you want that to be a compact set. Otherwise, your large deviation theory doesn't really work. So what we here, your rate function, if you look at it, p log p plus 1 minus p log 1 minus p is a bounded function. So your rate function is a bounded function. So your only hope of having compact level sets is the space is compact, because the function is bounded. So once you take a bound big enough, you get whole space there. So the whole space might be compact. The question now is the space of functions bounded by 1 on the unit square compact in the cut topology? It's not compact in the strong topology. It's compact in the weak topology. But is it compact in the cut topology? Well, you think about it a little bit, and you convince yourself it cannot possibly be compact in the cut topology, because if you look at a function of two variables, if you integrate one variable, you get a projection, the marginal is the other variable. The sup is over A cross B, you take B to be whole space, you are still allowed complete freedom on A to take the sup. So the projections, you are taking sup over all A's, so the projections have to converge in the strong topology. And there is no way, you know, that can be true. Nothing is going to converge in the strong topology when you have all functions bounded by 1. So that's not in the cards. So the space is not compact. Is there a chance of X being compact? So what do we do? What have we ignored here? The labeling of the vertices is irrelevant. We have a permutation symmetry in the problem. Symmetry, the permutation symmetry translates to symmetry, the group of Meshet-preserving transformations of the unit interval in the quotient. When you pass to the limit on the functions of the square, our functions, we don't care what the limit function f is, you can take f of sigma x, sigma y, where sigma is a measure preserving transformation of the unit interval, and that's as good as f of x, y. So correct space to work with is a quotient space, x tilde, which is our space of functions modded out by this huge group of Mesher-Preserving transformations of the unit interval. It's a humongous group because it's the shadow or the ghost of the permutation group. So you look at orbits, and the distance you define as the cut distance, but inf along the orbit. That's the natural distance for the quotient space. So you have a nice metric space, which is the quotient space. Now the question is this compact? Fortunately, there is a theorem of Lavoisier and Chegedy which says it is. It's based on it's a consequence of what's known as Shemeridi's regularity lemma. What it is, it tells you, you take any graph, arbitrary graph, and you embed it like this, and then there is a permutation of it which always gives you a nice function. And you know what, so you give yourself an epsilon, okay, and then the k doesn't yet is not that important, that just to make sure that you have at least a few, that's not important. The epsilon gives you an m and an n naught, such that if you take any graph, arbitrary graph, there is a permutation of it which gives you an f which is epsilon close to a simple function with just m squares. The simple function with just m squares is an m square finite dimensional set. It's a compact set. So it tells you any arbitrary graph is within epsilon of a compact set after permutation. That's essentially telling you that the quotient space is compact. So there's some finite dimensional thing here, and my f that I embed is within epsilon of that. So that's the basis. And the reason the whole thing works is not only 2 to the n smaller than e to the cn square, even n factorial is smaller than e to the cn square, because n factorial is only e to the n log n. So instead of one set, I can look at all the permutations of it and take the union. The total in the scale of e to the n squared, that's going to be the same as any one of them. So I don't lose anything in my estimate by taking all the n factorial permutations and adding them up. So now I can explicitly state the variational problem that computes what the rate function is. I just look at the triple integral equal to c. That tells you that the number of triangles is proportional to c times n cubed. And then I minimize the entropy IPF over all of that. And that, by the contraction principle, is my loss deviation rate. The infimum is attained. That is a difficult theorem to prove, because unless you know something is compact, it's hard to prove the infimum is attained. It's only compact if you take the quotient in the cut topology. So on k tilde is where you have to do the variational problem, and k tilde is compact, and both the entropy and the triangle count are invariant under sigma transformations by sigma, because they're just integrals, and they're preserved under Mesher-preserving transformations. So all the problem you can do in k tilde. Now there is an interesting phase transition here. You can set up, you know, the infimum is attained, so you can write down the Euler equation at the infimum, which should be satisfied. And you can show by contraction argument, if the value you choose is very close to p cubed over 6, because the large deviation you are asking is a small large deviation, so to speak, then the solution is just constant. So in other words, if your number of triangles is just slightly above or below what you expect, it happened because the number of edges adjusted itself to produce the right number of triangles. So the graph looks like a similar graph with an adjusted p. On the other hand, if p is much less than 1, then there is a better option. And C is fixed. That means I'm taking C far away from P, but for the testing purposes, I would rather have P small and C the same effect. Then it's better to form cliques. So you want to, if you have to pay for an edge by entropy, think of entropy as just paying for an edge. You have to pay for an edge, and if you want lots of triangles, it's a waste of time to create edges all over the place. You would rather create the edges in one corner tightly, so for a very few number of edges, you can create most number of triangles. So that's what happens. Your C and P are very far apart. Your P is very small and C is not so small. But when P and C are close, the entropy wins over energy, and then therefore the constant is what's the best thing. So there's an interesting phase transition, and you can actually do it doing the variation problem. I just done some calculations, the simple calculation, to see why click is better. It's intuitively it's clear click is better, and you just compute it. So you get more triangles by forming cliques. Now, even if the other side also, suppose you don't want any triangles at all. If you don't want any triangles, there are no triangles, the theorem of Turan, which says the graph is bipartite, very close to bipartite graph. Bipartite graph means the graph is divided into two halves, and the only edges go from here to there. So there are no odd cycles. There are no triangles. So in order to create the situation, you only have to kill half the edges by making the p very small, which you need to do if you want to have p cubed by 6 nearly 0, you are killing all the edges. Why go the trouble of killing all the edges when it's sufficient to kill just half of them? So the optimizer is going to say kill only half. But if P is very close to C, it's better to lower all of them. So there is again a phase transition at this end and a phase transition at the other end. And you can, again, you can, it just tells you that half means in terms of the size of the box, half the above the diagonal is only one half. So if you to get a bipartite graph, you only need 1/4 factor. So it's cheaper to do that. So you can do these calculations, for any number of gammas. And now you have, if you want to fix certain number of gammas and so on, it's just different calculus of variation problem. You know. Everything comes from the counting functions phi gamma f and the entropy of f, which is very explicit in this case. So in this problem, it's not so much the large deviation principle is difficult or the rate function is hard to obtain and so on. It's the topology that makes this problem interesting, that the Shamiradi's lemma, which is a very powerful lemma, and its consequences allow us to use this strange space in which to do the calculation, although the final result, namely the existence of phase transitions and so on, have nothing to do with this topology, but the topology is a tool in doing these problems. We are now going to do the same thing for random matrices. Now, if you take a random matrix Xij with independent entries, mean 0, let's say, and they have a nice tail, and you it's a symmetric matrix, you compute its eigenvalues that are real, you have an eigenvalues lambda 1, etc., lambda n. There's a theorem of Wigner's semicircle law, which tells you that if you they're all of order square root of n, and if you scale them by square root of n, their frequency follows the semicircle law, and actually to go, you won't find any outside the circle, not even one or two. But the probability of finding one or two outside is exponentially small. It's like e to the minus a constant times n or something like that. And these are known results. So now I'm going to be more brutal. I'm looking at eigenvalues of size n. Eigenvalues of size n don't exist that easily. In fact, if you divide by n, all the eigenvalues will collapse to zero. So if you pass to the limit, then it will be zero and nothing else. But in principle, it's conceivable with a very small probability that a random matrix will have an eigenvalue of size n. You can just have one large value or a few large values. It's possible. So there's a small chance that they are not. So I want to know what is the probability that a few survive. And these probabilities will be very small, the order n square, and they're like e to the minus c times n square plus little over n square. I'm interested in determining the c. So the only possibility is the limiting points can be a sequence of points on the spectrum which go to zero. You can't have point of accumulation anywhere away from zero. If you want that, the probability will be even smaller than e to the minus n square, e to the minus n cubed or whatever. So I'm interested in e to the minus c n cubed stuff. So all I am allowed here is a sequence sigma j that has zero as a limit point. So I'm given this spectrum S. I want to know what is the large deviation rate function. How do you compute that c as a function of S? And also, when you are dealing with square root of n and so on, there is universality. And this is the answer does not depend on the distribution of the entries of the random matrix. But here, the answer we get will depend on the distribution. So this is not, although the phenomena is universal, the answers are not universal. So I want to compute this C as a function of S. What is it? I have a formula for it. What is this formula? So you take phi jx is an orthonormal family of functions in L2. It doesn't have to be complete. It could be countable or uncountable and so on. And then you compute this sum. we can think of this sum as a kernel whose eigenvalues are these. That's all this is. If you think of Mersenne's theorem, this is a kernel whose eigenvalues are these and probably some zeros which never show up here. And this H is the, which is a function of this real number, is the Kramer rate function for the IAD distribution. You have a sequence of independent random variables, xij, they have a moment generating function, and you take the log of the moment generating function and the conjugate convex to it, and that's what this function H is. So you put that H and integrate dx dy, and of course there are all possible eigenfunctions here, and you minimize over them all, and that's your C of S. Why is that true? It turns out it's not that difficult. If you interpret it carefully, it's obvious. And that's what take me 5 minutes or so, and then I think I'll end a little early today. So you can either think of it as a kernel, as a set of eigenvalues of this kernel. So the question really is, where does this kernel come from? So the kernel inside is just this summation. So it's a kernel rate function. So, you know, if you're a Gaussian tail, then HK is quadratic, so that means your kernel K is Hilbert-Schmidt, and so the eigenvalues exist and they go to zero and so on. So you can get control on it by rate of growth of H gives you control on these things. So you are embedding this as a matrix. The matrix X like J gets embedded as this kernel K. I want to do a large deviation principle for K in the cut topology. Now you can look at the spectrum of this K. The spectrum of this K are basically the eigenvalues of xij divided by n, and lots of zeros thrown in. Because I use functions rather than infinite dimensional, but there is a constant in the box, and you take the eigenvalue for the constant, and then the rest of it is a whole lot of zero eigenfunctions are here. But the non-zero eigenvalues are nothing but the eigenvalues of xij divided by n, because the you can check that the fact that I'm looking at it in with respect to the Lebesgue measure and the unit interval, and you know the intervals are this small, makes it that way. So all I need to know is large deviations for this in the cut topology. I did this before when xij was 0 or 1. Now I have arbitrary random variables. For Kramer's theorem, it doesn't matter. Zeros and ones, you can replace them by arbitrary random variables. And when you do it by arbitrary random variables, then all you get is the Kramer rate function there. Instead of, see, for the Kramer rate function for the binomial is the entropy. So when you replace the binomial by arbitrary random variables, you're going to get exactly the Kramer rate function. So there's a moral to this story for all this is done. If you have a random matrix of size n by n, and if you see a few eigenvalues that are of order n, just happen to see it, then you can rearrange the matrix by a permutation using the same permutation for rows and columns. You're just relabeling the variables. Then, in the cut topology, a kernel K will suddenly emerge from this chaos as a limit. And the eigenvalues of this K normalized, you know, will be the original eigenvalues normalized by R. This tells you how eigenvalues, such large eigenvalues with such small probabilities, arise in a random matrix. Okay? That's it. Thank you.